from WBUR, Boston, and NPR. I'm Ray Suarez of Al Jazeera America, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Today brought bombs, death, and suffering to another European capital, this time in Brussels, headquarters city of the European Union. The attacks came during the morning rush hour, hitting the main international airport and the metro. Dozens are dead, many more are injured. At least one of the explosions is being called a suicide attack. Now, Brussels is on virtual lockdown. Residents have been told to avoid all movement. This hour, On Point, the attacks in Brussels, and what we know now, just days after the arrest in Belgium of one of the reputed masterminds of last year's Paris attacks. You can join us on air or online. What's your reaction to news of another attack in Europe? Is the world just becoming one big soft target? Will another European attack raise yet more anxiety far away in the United States about the threat of terrorism? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Earlier today, I spoke with Julian Barnes, correspondent for the Wall Street Journal in Brussels, Belgium. Since we recorded this interview, ISIS has claimed responsibility for the Belgium attacks. I talked to Barnes about the investigation, when the air is full of the cries of the wounded and the dying, when an enormous public place like an airport terminal is destroyed, the roof blown out, glass smashed. You have to secure the place. You have to attend to those who are hurt. But then what? How does an international police organization, a domestic security force, start to unravel something like this?
Well, look, this started to unfold about a week ago when a team of Belgian and French police stumbled upon what turned out to be the hideout of Salah Abdeslam, one of the Paris planners and attackers. A gun battle ensued. One person, gunman was killed. Inside that apartment was a flag of the Islamic State, radical Islamic literature, and the police realized that they were on the trail of one of the Paris attackers, as well as this network of Syrian-trained fighters that was beside him. Salah Abdeslam was captured on Friday, along with one of the Syrian-trained men. Yesterday, we had an alert where they came out and said they were looking for another one of these men. So this city was already on alert for this particular cell of Syrian-trained fighters with ties to Islamic State. Over the weekend, when it came out that this cell was planning more attacks, you saw lots more police on the street. Army deployed to secure relations. So you had folks on alert before these attacks. The attacks happen. We now have police conducting raids, trying to get after people they may be connected.
General Wesley Clark, the former NATO Supreme Commander in Europe, someone who knows Brussels well, called it a use-it-or-lose-it attack. What is that?
Well, when Salah Abdeslam was captured, he started cooperating with police. He started talking. His lawyer said he was talking. Belgian officials said that. So it may have been the case. Some U.S. officials have told me that they believe there was an attack planned, and the remaining members of the cell thought, we better do this now, or else we will be sooner rather than later captured and won't be able to do the attack. So that's what a kind of use it or lose it moment kind of means in this context.
So you feel the noose tightening, you've got a plan, and you pull the trigger on it because you want to get it done before you get caught?
That's right. It's possible that they had this, they originally had a schedule of a week from now or a month from now, or maybe it didn't even have a set date. And then they realized that the noose, as you said, was tightening, the police were coming closer on them, and that they would be, because each member of this network that you roll up, you get closer and closer to the other members.
When the investigation of the Bataclan and restaurant attacks in Paris of last year extended to Brussels, to a neighborhood filled with people who had moved into Belgium from parts of the Arabic-speaking world, was there a contrast in the methods, the manner, the intensity of the attention that Belgium had paid to this population versus France? And was perhaps the Belgian response weaker in some ways?
Well, it is true that Belgium does not have the security apparatus that France does. It does not. The security services are probably better trained and have a more successful record, perhaps, than the Belgian system. Belgium is also a fractured country where it doesn't have a strong central government in the same way that France does. It's much more power devolved to individual regions. And critics have said that has prevented a kind of holistic response within Belgium and got in the way of sort of cross-border cooperation as well. But you have to also remember the situation in terms of the mix of how populations mix is a little bit different in Belgium than it is in France. In some ways, things are more integrated and better in Belgium than they are in other parts. But as has been pointed out, you still have very concentrated neighborhoods where there have been some radical mosques, and that like in the section of Molenbeek that has been under attention since the Paris attacks.
Julian, thanks a lot. Julian Barnes is European security correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. He spoke with me from Brussels. Great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, early today, we heard from people who had witnessed the attack itself, who had been on the scene. A Brussels airport worker spoke with the BBC about what happened in the aftermath of the first explosion.
50 meters of us was a big explosion. First we thought it was a billboard falling down or something. My colleague was looking and was wondering, what is it? And I said, run, we ran away.
We turn now to Paris, scene of deadly terror attacks back in November. Nicholas Vinokur is a reporter for Politico. He focuses on far-right politics, terrorism, and radicalism. He's been following the news out of Brussels. Nicholas, thanks a lot for joining us.
Good to be here.
Now, here we have a European capital on lockdown, hundreds of flights canceled, the international rail services, Thalys and Eurostar, shut down. For a couple of euros worth of material, if you can find somebody who's ready to give their life, you can cause millions of dollars of knock-on effects, huh?
Absolutely. It's a small cost for an immeasurable amount of damage to the economy and also to people's sense of security.
When there is a high-profile arrest, when police are in the process of what they feel may be rolling up a cell, is there a heightened security laid on in other areas? Just because of the anticipation of the attacks from the strays, the people who haven't been arrested yet?
There has certainly been a heightened terror alert in Brussels during the final moments of the manhunt and actually in the past few days, because they told us that further attacks were possible. Now, the attacks from strays is a hypothesis at this point, and you know, we're not sure where the people who carried out today's attacks came from. It might have been connected to the cell, Salah Abdeslam's cell, or they may have come from elsewhere. But in any case, there's going to be a lot of questions about Belgium's handling of the security threat within its borders.
When you approach an airport in Western Europe to get on a plane, you can get or can you get, pretty far into the process before someone actually submits you to a security screening. These bombs went off in the departure halls in an area where people still had their luggage, still had not cleared customs or passport control. Can you penetrate deep into public areas, in not only in Brussels, but at Heathrow in London, at Orly in Paris, in Tegelhof in Berlin? Is this something that's common throughout the continent?
Sure. In Europe, in principle at least, we have the idea of free movement within the European Union's borders, and that means sites like train stations and airports, smaller size airports, typically don't have the same type of controls that you would find at JFK. I would say that, the attack today took place in a common area, you'd find it perhaps just as easy to get into if it was the common area of Chicago's O'Hare Airport or New York's JFK. These are sites that are impossible to lock down absolutely. There is a military presence in train stations and airports. But even today, right after the bombing, some people were overheard saying, "Where are the soldiers? Where are the people meant to protect us?" And the simple answer is they can't be everywhere at once. And you can't have an absolute guarantee that there will be no attack. All you can do is try to find the individuals who are ready to do such things.
Nicholas Vinokur covers politics, terrorism, and radicalism for Politico. He spoke with me from Paris. Nick, thanks for taking the time. I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about this morning's attacks in Brussels, Belgium. Hear the sound of emergency vehicle sirens as authorities evacuated the Brussels airport following two explosions there. You can join the conversation. What's your response to these attacks? Joining me now from Washington is Bruce Hoffman, director of the Center for Security Studies and director of the Security Studies Program at Georgetown University. He's author of Anonymous Soldiers, which is out in paperback today. Bruce Hoffman, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks, Ray.
And from Bethesda, Maryland, we're joined by Ruel Marc-Gerecht, senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. He's a former CIA case officer focused on the Middle East. Great to have you with us.
My pleasure.
Well, gentlemen, I want to start with the European response and then move quickly to that in the United States. Do you think, Bruce Hoffman, we will see a change, or are changes already being contemplated, not just in Belgium, but elsewhere in Europe, to the level of surveillance, to the efforts to break up these cells of immigrants?
I think that certainly the cellular structure of terrorist organizations, not least ISIS, in places like Belgium, France, and elsewhere is much more extensive and much deeper than has been imagined. So the fact that just 4 days following Saleh Abdeslam's arrest, that the remnants of his cell or of a parallel cell were able to mount this attack suggests that this is not the last that we've heard of this type of incident. So I suspect there will be profound changes.
Ruel?
I think the French and the Belgian security services are first going to look to see if they can identify these individuals, if they were actually in their sights. If they discover that these folks are new, then I think you will have a considerable panic breakout amongst the Belgians, the French, and other Europeans because, the Belgians, this is really too much for them. They don't have the type of security service that can handle this. The French, who do have the finest counterterrorism force in Europe, are already stressed. So, if they find out that they've got a cell that they didn't really know about, this is going to be very bad news.
At a news conference this morning, Belgian Prime Minister Charles Michel called today's attacks blind, violent, and cowardly. He called for solidarity. Here he is, interpreted by France 24.
In this tragic moment, so dark moment for our country, I will call everyone to show calm and solidarity. This is a challenge, a difficult challenge, and we need to face this challenge being unified, solidaire, and united.
Through translation, that's the Belgian Prime Minister Charles Michel today in Brussels. We're getting a variety of feedback on Facebook. Gustavo writes, the deep security state will now ask for more money and power, as they always do, but it is important to remember they will accomplish absolutely nothing, as they always do. Robert writes, it is indeed time to declare war in the West on radical Islam. They come here, resent us all the while on welfare, and plot against us and undermine our resolve by exploiting political correctness and white guilt. And Sam Winston writes, not surprised this is happening on the same day as a primary. It's probably the U.S. who's responsible. 800-423-8255. Let's go to Sean, who's calling us from Clarksville, Tennessee. Sean, welcome to the program.
Hi.
What's on your mind, Sean?
My comment is that we need to end this violence and we need to become true peacemakers. We're always on the offense right now, fighting wars in the Middle East, and we're just beginning more violence.
Sean, thanks a lot for your call. Lewis is on the line from Nashville, Tennessee. Lewis?
Hi.
Hi, what's up, Lewis?
How are you doing? I just wanted to comment as well. Me and my wife, we woke up this morning to the news of Brussels. We have a trip planned to Germany. And with all the ongoing terror in Europe, we just feel so insecure that we plan on probably just canceling our trip to Europe. And it's something that we hear all the time, and it's a growing, you know, terror for all of us.
Stay on the line, Lewis, because I think this speaks directly to the logic of terrorism. A very simple, straightforward plot to walk into a public place with a bomb, probably consisting of a few dollars worth of parts, and thousands of miles away, people are thinking of changing their lives. Bruce Hoffman, Rua Markgerecht, how would you advise Lewis, one family trying to make a decision about whether to go to Berlin and Istanbul? Ruel first.
I wouldn't change my plans at all. I mean, the truth about terrorism still is the odds of getting hit by it are quite small. I mean, you're in far more danger when you get in your car and you go on the highway. I'm going to be leaving to Istanbul shortly with my son, and I intend to, you know, walk down Istiklal Caddesi where they had the terror attack the other day. It's quite understandable that the fear, and certainly in Brussels, when you have to lock down the city, that amplifies the tension and your anxiety. But I think changing plans is not wise. And I think the French security services and the Belgian security services, you know, will slowly be able to get a grip on this. It's going to be extremely difficult because you do have the possibility of unknown cells popping up. But the truth is, in Europe, as this problem gets worse, the security services will respond more vigorously and aggressively. Now, civil liberties may suffer in that process, and one has to be constantly alert to that. But I wouldn't sell the European security services short.
And Bruce Hoffman, doesn't Lewis's question, his anxiety, speak directly to the logic of terrorism, what they do this for?
of course, terrorism only works if people are terrorized. And what terrorists are trying to do is, firstly, force people to behave differently, to become paranoid, to become withdrawn, to become xenophobic. They're trying to force otherwise liberal societies and governments to become even more, to become illiberal by imposing all sorts of constraints on civil liberties. And they're trying to undermine confidence in political systems. So, you know, at the end of the day, I mean, you often have two extremes. On the one hand, people say, well, terrorism isn't an existential threat. But, of course, if you're one of the two dozen people who have been killed in Brussels this morning, or the 100 or so have been injured, it seems pretty existential. But on the other hand, I mean, just as Rule said, terrorism is low on the list of things that you probably would suffer from or be harmed by traveling abroad.
But so what would you tell Lewis?
Well, I mean, look, this is not new. This has been going on since the 1970s and the 1980s. And I went on my honeymoon to Europe in 1986 when Americans stayed away from Europe after we had bombed Libya and Libya had promised retaliation. I think you have to make your own decisions, what's best for you from a logical perspective, understanding that the odds of being harmed in terrorism are quite low. But at the same time, I mean, terrorism does occur, but it occurred 4 months ago in Paris, for example. It's not a, unfortunately, it's not a daily omnipresent threat.
So let me bring Lewis back into the conversation. You heard what Ruhl Marcgerecht and Bruce Hoffman had to say in the way of advice. What do you think, Lewis?
Well, it definitely helps me and my wife think a little bit better of the situation over there. We it's unknown territory for us, so whenever we hear news about these things, it definitely makes us feel insecure. And every day, you know, you hear these things ongoing, but it's like Bruce was saying, that you get in a car and it's a higher chance of getting in a car accident than running into a terrorist attack. So, you know, you just got to do it, I guess. You got to just hope for the best and just watch out for those things when you're out there, I guess.
Well, Lewis, good luck whatever you decide. If you do go, send On Point a postcard so we know that you went. Lewis calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Bruce Hoffman, Ruhl Marcgerecht, what happens in way of response in the United States when there's an attack like this, here in particular on the headquarters city of the European Union, the home of the European Command for NATO? What happens here? What things are kicked into higher gear? What processes, what communications go on between all the various parties? Bruce?
Well, I mean, certainly it's a little bit of an apples and oranges because, of course, there is an entrenched terrorist network in Europe that I don't think exists in the United States. And you just have to contrast the San Bernardino killings with either Paris or Brussels, and you can see the difference. I mean, lone individuals acting for, you know, a confusing array of often personal motives. And here in both Paris and Brussels, you have simultaneous terrorist attacks by an existing organization. In the United States, I mean, there's a tremendous advantage. You have the National Counterterrorism Center, the Department of Homeland Security, and certainly the FBI, which takes the lead on all domestic terrorism, and plus the panoply of state and local police forces. So in places like New York, doubtless NYPD, for example, is on heightened alert, paying attention to make sure that there isn't any, you know, any possibility of copycat attacks or people attempting to emulate it. But I would say the coordination around the United States is much stronger than you see, you know, across European states.
Ruhl Marcgerecht, do you agree that the problem in the United States is very different from that in Europe?
Yeah, it's vastly less. I mean, I've spent a fair amount of time visiting radical Muslim, radical mosques in Europe, particularly in France and Belgium. And that type of environment, the communities that surround it, simply don't exist in the United States. Now, that's not to say that the United States couldn't have a problem. It's not to say that you couldn't have people come to the United States and cause problems. But the FBI is in a much better position to handle these things. That's not to say that the FBI, for example, is as competent as, say, the French Internal Security Service. I don't think it is, but the threat before it is considerably less. So I think the United States is in a relatively good position. That's not to say that you're not going to have an increase of liaison activity. You certainly are. That's not to say that the FBI, I mean, they're working around the clock and major cities in the United States on these issues already. I mean, they will up their efforts. The National Security Agency will probably monitor more closely certain communications. So there will be, you know, an increased effort. But the real issue is in Europe, and to some extent, and it's underappreciated in the United States, the Europeans, particularly the French and the British, have been sort of our advance guard. They have actually been protecting us. So we can only wish them well in that effort, because if they lose track of folks and those individuals have European passports, then, of course, they can get to the United States.
Our number here at On Point, 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. The president is speaking in Cuba and addressed the terrorist attack in Belgium. He said, "We stand in solidarity with them. This is yet another reminder that the world must unite." President Obama vowed the U.S. will do whatever is necessary to support our friend and ally Belgium in bringing to justice those who are responsible. He said, "We must together, regardless of nationality or faith or race, join in fighting against the scourge of terrorism." We're just now getting a report that three Americans were injured in the Brussels attack. Earlier today, the French Prime Minister Manuel Valls spoke about the attacks in Brussels.
Nous sommes en guerre. Nous subissons depuis plusieurs mois.
He said, "We are at war. For several months, we've been subjected to acts of war in Europe." Pretty early on, Bruce Hoffman, the investigations into the Bataclan and restaurant attacks led back to Belgium. What do we know about the communities there and the ties between Belgium, Brussels, and Paris?
Well, the ties are quite extensive, because I think, just as Raoul said, I would also rate the French security and intelligence services as amongst the best in the world. But, you know, the reality in Europe is that a nation is only as strong as its most vulnerable neighbor is. And in that case, it seems very obvious that the attacks in Paris in November were planned and plotted from Belgium. Belgium, although it has a smaller population than France, has a far higher proportion of foreign fighters that have left Belgium. And unfortunately, this is the problem, that have repeatedly traversed the European continent on land or by air in going back and forth between Syria and Belgium, and then, of course, launching attacks in France. It wasn't just the attacks last November. Of course, last August, there was an attack on a high-speed train en route from Brussels to Paris as well. So Brussels has emerged, or Belgium in particular, has emerged as a focus of ISIS and of terrorist activity. And I think the problem is underscored of even when you know the neighborhood, this is this Molenbeek neighborhood of Brussels, where there is a large population of immigrants. I mean, this has been the focus of intensive police and intelligence activity in the 4 months since Paris, and yet Saleh Abdeslam, one of the ringleaders of the Paris attacks, went undetected, living only a few blocks from the neighborhood he grew up in, where his family lives.
And there's said to be another man, Najim Laachroui, who goes by the name Soufiane Kayal, somewhere at large in Western Europe, and now gaining the attention of security services around the continent. A marked man, apparently, but someone who had until then escaped the attention as he moved freely between the two countries. Go ahead, quickly.
In my view, he's the new face of terrorism. When I first started studying terrorism or working as an analyst 40 years ago, the dominant profession were, in essence, teachers. Today, we're finding more and more engineers, just like Laachroui.
This On Point podcast is supported by Squarespace, the simplest way to create a beautiful website. Whether your passion is bold, unconventional, or just plain crazy, you should share it with the world in an unforgettable way. Start your free trial today at squarespace.com/onpoint. That's squarespace.com/onpoint. And enter offer code ONPOINT at checkout to get 10% off your first purchase.
This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the attacks this morning at the Brussels airport and in the metro. You can join the conversation. Are you reminded of the Paris attacks just a few months ago? You can follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We're talking with Ruel Marc-Gerecht, Senior Fellow at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, and with Bruce Hoffman, Director of the Center for Security Studies and Director of the Security Studies Program at Georgetown University. As I mentioned, the president spoke just a short time ago in Cuba.
The world must unite. We must be together, regardless of nationality or race or faith, in fighting against the scourge of terrorism.
With the talk of unity, of common cause and common purpose, that's pushing back against, I guess, the logic of terrorism, which is to create division. Ruel Marc-Gerecht, are we looking at a Europe that's really rethinking this passport-free, visa-free, free movement zone that takes up much of the western part of the continent?
Yeah, I mean, I think for the time being, Schengen is dead as a doornail. I mean, borders are being closed all over the place. You've got, you know, pileups occurring throughout Western Europe, which is the, you know, heart of the Schengen idea. So, and the refugee issue actually is, I think, the primary driver here, not the terrorism, though terrorism is now obviously a significant factor. So, combining the problem of jihad and the problem of immigration, I think the Europeans have decided to, put those borders back up and to amplify the security and surveillance on border crossings.
Bruce, does the simplicity of an attack like this, just carry a bomb into a public place and blow it up, really work against attempts to stop these kinds of things? This is not something necessarily where there's going to be a tremendous amount of communication, chatter, coordination of large numbers of people. Get a guy, have him carry a bomb into a place and blow it up.
Well, you know, firstly, the problem with these types of bombs is that they're made from ordinarily readily available commercial materials. If they use TATP, which has sort of been a staple of these types of attacks from the Paris days, it's basically nail polish remover and hydrogen peroxide hair bleach. So the ingredients are very accessible. What you need is the expertise, and that's why I made the point about this latest terrorist figure having a degree in electromechanical engineering and having a greater sophistication to actually put the bombs together and deploy them. And then you have the problem that literally any place that is public is vulnerable. You can lock down Brussels itself and have a heightened security presence at all the major targets there. But at the end of the day, then you just go out to the airport on the outskirts of town and you target the departures area, which of course is insecure because passengers haven't passed through security checks yet. Or you just stop, you know, go to any metro stop. So it's almost impossible, not almost, it's impossible to protect, you know, every conceivable target everywhere all the time. And this is the advantage the terrorists have and how they're able to sow fear and create this profound anxiety and panic, because they have the ability to program and time their attacks wherever they believe will be the most vulnerable type of target, which is to say a target with lots of innocent people around it.
Let's go back to the phones. Wayne is with us now from Nashville, Tennessee. Wayne, welcome.
Hi, Ray. Question for your panel is, you know, how much of the issues we're seeing in Europe with terrorists could be an issue of failures of integration of governments and communities and the marginalization of certain groups of people in these nations and also hereby extension in the U.S.
Ruel Marc-Gerecht, what do you think of Wayne's point?
Well, that's an excellent question. It's a difficult one to answer well. I mean, there's no question about it that Muslim communities in Europe have had a much more difficult time integrating into the United States. I mean, and into the European societies. That's at the same time. I mean, we have seen terrorists come out of Europe from families that were integrated. We have seen converts to Islam from individuals who might not be at the top of the social ladder, but at the same time weren't necessarily at the bottom of the social ladder. So that it is a factor, I think, is true, but I think one has to be careful about using that and trying to put the blame on European societies. I think European societies, they don't integrate as well as the United States does, by and large. They aren't melting pots, but, given their backgrounds, particularly, say, in France, I think the integration has been reasonably successful. It's been more successful than the French realize, but it is a difficult, it is a conundrum. European nationalities are deep, they're rich, they're thick, and it's difficult for foreigners when they come into them to integrate quickly.
Coming to us from onpointradio.org, Raspberry Swirl writes, "I am distraught reading the updates regarding this horrific tragedy. It is undeniable that it brings to us strong emotions. We can and should consider and carefully vet out in this moment what actions or inactions or wrong actions, decisions or misguided decisions help unleash this stream of terrorism." James writes, "Every time one of these attacks happen, the media and political elite act like this is the worst thing that has ever happened ever. So the politicians continue to do things to protect the people, and they seemingly keep failing and acting like these attacks are the worst thing ever. Ergo, it feeds into the idea that drastic measures must be taken." And Thinkin15 writes, "Striking out blindly in anger and fear is not a good strategy. That's how we got big wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. ISIS isn't a uniformed army marching in a line to Paris, Brussels, the U.S. I wish conservatives could get beyond their reptilian emotions and reactions." Well, without the partisan particularities, Bruce Hoffman, does an attack like this during an election season in the United States heighten the use of, the discussion of, attacks like these as an issue?
Absolutely, and this is what the terrorists are calculating. They're trying to steal some of the limelight and elbow their way into the debate and into the discussion. And it is remarkable because, after all, in the past at least three elections, presidential elections, terrorism was not a major issue. But certainly in the wake of both Paris and the San Bernardino shootings, it has moved front and center and become much more a focus of the debate than really at any time since the immediate aftermath of 9/11.
But you've both been talking about the differences between the United States and Europe. Is the conversation that we're having here calibrated, realistically related to the level of the threat?
I think it is, because really, with few exceptions, the San Bernardino shootings, the Fort Hood shootings in 2009, the United States and the Boston Marathon attack, of course, 3 years ago, the United States has largely avoided the large-scale mass casualty incidents that we've seen in Madrid, London, Paris, and now Brussels. So, one can deride the quote-unquote emergence of a security state, but at the same time, citizens anywhere in the world look to their governments to protect them, and to protect them even from infrequent, sporadic, but nonetheless tragic events like terrorism. And in the United States, I think the success of the federal government, yes, billions have been spent on security, we've created entire new agencies. Was it too much or was it an overreaction? Yes, obviously to an extent it was, but at the same time, though, it has been enormously successful in the United States in preventing preventing mass casualty attacks such as those we saw this morning in Brussels.
Ruel Marc-Gerecht, same question.
I don't think we're on the precipice of creating security states in Europe, and certainly not in the United States. And I think the Americans and the Europeans have largely responded to the real threat of Islamic militancy and jihadism with, for the most part, a great deal of responsibility and moderation. I mean, there have been abuses. There always are abuses. But for the most part, I think the Europeans and the Americans have responded to this threat pretty well. I mean, no government can stand to have its major public venues, its national airports, or its metros bombed. I mean, you can't just idly sit by. You're going to have to respond to that. And if they continue, you will respond to it more aggressively. But I do think that the notion of civil liberties, even in a place like France, where it's always had a much more intrusive state, that the regard for civil liberties is still real and is still quite vibrant.
This morning on CBS, former deputy director of the CIA, Mike Morrell, said Europe will stay on high alert for the time being.
ISIS has a large and sophisticated terrorist network in Europe that has not been degraded, that has not been unraveled. I think that's the key issue here. I think the next few days, the threat level is very high going forward for two reasons. One is terrorist attacks bring out copycats. And I think you also have to worry about what other large attacks did Salah Abdeslam have in train that might get accelerated over the next few weeks or months.
You know, this heightened security going forward doesn't happen in an against a neutral backdrop, Bruce Hoffman. Right now, European governments are arguing about how to handle large refugee inflows from the Middle East and from Africa. Does this put pressure on the government of Angela Merkel? Does it strengthen the hand of David Cameron? What changes now that there's been yet another attack?
Well, this is precisely the terrorists' purpose, is to polarize societies already enmeshed in very fractious debates, to compel from public pressure politicians to react in extreme fashions. And, of course, the pressure on both of them will be intense. I mean, look at Merkel's, you know, popularity has almost completely flipped since the summer as a result of the immigration issue. And then on top of that, the accentuation of this issue by the Paris attacks and now the Brussels attacks. So absolutely this plays a role. And that's what the terrorists want, as I said a minute ago. It's to push liberal societies to behave more liberally and to polarize those societies as well. That's the means that terrorists basically harvest to heighten fear and anxiety and make people both paranoid and indeed xenophobic.
Ruel Gerecht, for people who don't follow this very closely, the idea that Islamist organizations might be actively trying to make things worse for Muslim refugees coming to Europe almost seems a little counterintuitive. Unravel that for the casual listener.
Well, I mean, if you visit radical Islamic bookstores in Europe, you will see an abundance of literature that talks about the great fear and threat of Western culture and Western civilization. That is, they are scared to death that more and more Muslims in Europe are integrating, which they are. And so the desire on the part of these militants is to stop that integration. It is to stop the melting pot that has actually been working in many European countries, maybe not as well as we would like, as the Europeans would like, but it certainly worked better than Islamic militants like. So anything you can do to disturb that and to polarize the situation, to make Muslims themselves think of themselves in sort of classical terms, that is, believer and unbeliever, is something you want to accentuate. And terrorism does it quite well. You can see it across Europe, where you have the rise of the right, and even on the left, you see you know, vocabulary being used in, that one wouldn't have seen not that long ago.
Does the Brussels attack carry with it the possibility of succeeding to that degree, that organizations, international terror networks might be convincing European governments that it's time to take a much harder look at the people arriving in dinghies and small fishing boats?
I mean, I think the answer to that is yes, but at the same time, I think European officials are well aware that if you look at the individuals who perpetrated these terrorist attacks, a very high percentage of them are native European-born militant Muslims. They are not refugees, and that the vast majority of refugees pose no threat to the societies that they are in. But no doubt about it, the public reaction to this, because of the great difficulties of integration in the Muslim ghettos that exist in many countries in Europe, particularly in places like Belgium and France and Holland, it accentuates this anxiety and makes things a lot worse.
You don't punch people in the nose that you can't reach. You punch the person who's handiest, yeah. Right? I mean, it may not be refugees who are doing these things, and in fact, many have been homegrown. But you can't root out those neighborhoods and empty them out or send people home, nor would you want to.
Yeah, I mean, I there is a tendency sometimes, I think, to, you know, overdo the extent to which the Europeans have become anti-Muslim. I think that by and large, I mean, there's a problem there. There's a problem on the Muslim side in that you do have amongst the young a growing political identity that has merged with the faith that sort of discourages integration. But I still think that the divisions there are not insurmountable.
I want to thank my guests, Bruce Hoffman, director of the Center for Security Studies and director of the Security Studies Program at Georgetown University. His book, Anonymous Soldiers, is out in paperback today. And Ruel Marc Garecht, senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Great to have you both. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpoint.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook. Coming up tomorrow, two veteran reporters travel the country talking to Americans about hope, anger, and the presidential election. I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.